call together a meeting of the SURF Fund. I think there's just two, the special meeting, there's two issues on the agenda. One is the determination of what the assumed rate of return will be to determine what the city's annual contribution will be to the SURF Fund for the upcoming fiscal budget. And the other issue is, correct me if I'm wrong, Carolyn, our legal counsel being involved in the contract with Markham to conduct the election for the two union trustees on the board. Is that correct? I think you're muted. All right. Starting with item number one.
That's correct, Jerry.
With item number one, is this something that is going to be handled by Rich initially or by a legal counsel?
No, I think by Hooker and Holcomb.
Okay, yeah, Rich, you take the lead.
Sure. thank you, everybody. Good morning. Hope everybody's doing well. We're going to be going through an exhibit or a report as far as an experience study for the SURF plan is concerned. Does everybody have a copy of that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I see some heads nodding. Before we get into the experience study, I wanted to give everybody a little bit of background on evaluation and why the assumptions are important. So what we do when we do evaluation is we collect data at every valuation date. We reconcile it with the data we got from the last valuation. And when I say reconcile, we want to be able to identify people who retired, people who terminated, new employees, people who may have passed away, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the first step in our process is to update data and make sure we have data as of a particular date. And for purposes of the study and the current valuation, we're using July 1, 2020. So we've done that. When we do evaluation, what we do is we take all of that data, we program your plan into our valuation system. We project every person out to retirement and then eventually death. And let me just pick groups. For retirees, we know who the retirees are. We know what they're collecting. So we project cash flows out into the future. We take into account probabilities of mortality, probabilities of death of either the retiree or the beneficiary. And we project everybody out until the last benefit payment for retirees. So we have a cash flow for retirees. For actives, it's a little bit more complicated, but it's basically the same process. So if somebody's actively employed, we project them to an assumed retirement age. We take into account probabilities of turnover, salary increases, possibilities of death and a death benefit being paid. And when they reach retirement, we have an estimated benefit that they're going to collect, and we project that until that individual passes away and or a potential beneficiary. So as part of the valuation process, so now what we've done is we've generated this stream of cash flows for the entire group until the last person dies. So these cash flows typically go out for 100 years. The next step in the process is we take all of those cash flows and we discount them back to today using the investment return assumption. That discounting of all those future cash flows is what generates the accrued liability. So if everything goes exactly as we expect, the liability we've generated is the liability for the fund. Now, what we do once every 5 years is we do what's called an experience study. So what we're actually doing is we're looking at what our assumptions are for retirement, for turnover, for salary increases, et cetera. We compare that to what's actually happened. And so we want to make sure those are in alignment. If we need to make some adjustments, we're proposing adjustments. If the assumptions we have are reasonably close, then we're going to suggest leaving them alone. Those assumptions change the future benefit payments that we're projecting. So they're important to make sure that they're reasonably close. The most important assumption is the investment return assumption, which is what we use to discount everything back. So what you'll see, it's on PDF page 3. It's actually report page 1. It's the impact on the 2020 actual evaluation results. So in the first section where it says current basis, thank you, Leanna. Yep, right there. Just go up a little bit. Yep. So current basis is all of the existing assumptions. So if we take all of our existing assumptions in our new population, this is what some refer to as it's the baseline. This is our starting point. And for a starting point, our accrued liability is $463 million, which is that process I just described. Normal cost is a similar process. Basically what it is we try to determine the cost of the benefits accruing in the upcoming year, going through that similar process of projecting everything out. That cost of benefits accruing in the upcoming year is the $1.26 million. Once we have those two calculations, we look at the assets, compare it to the liabilities. That creates an unfunded. We have an amortization. We add normal cost, and that produces the 23.3. So what we did is we went back, we looked at 5 years worth of experience and said, went through each one of the assumptions and determined whether there needed to be a change or not a change. Dan's going to go through that in just a second, but that recommendation, so if the recommendations we have on any changes in assumptions produce a liability that's $474 million, $10.6 million higher, and a normal cost that's 1.3 versus 1.26. What we're going to talk about today is basically two different assumptions or methods that we want to kind of just touch base with you on. The most important one being the investment return assumption. Typically, an investment return assumption is an assumption that you want to work, you know, collaboratively with the board and your investment advisor on what is an expected long-term rate of return on the assets. So what we're providing you with is some sensitivity. You're currently at 7.75. We also did a run using 7% investment return to get you some sensitivity on the impact on the ADEC or the annual required contribution.
Can I ask you a quick question here?
Yes.
Michael tried to explain this to me. I still don't understand it. So I thought we were already using a 7.75% investment return rate, but you're saying here that that's not the case. Like, what is the current basis?
The current basis is 7.75. So what you see in that middle section is if we reflect all of the proposed changes that we have to the assumptions, non-investment return assumptions, this is the impact on the contribution.
I'm just looking at the $10.6 million increase. So, but that's our current situation. So this is not, this would, we're not assuming a $2.78 million increase annually in what we're required to pay, because we're already incorporating that in our current budget, because we're already using a 7.75% investment return. Is that correct?
7.75 is used to determine this calculation. The 2.78 million increase is because of other changes.
Okay. Which,
so why don't we
I see. So because you have done this 5-year analysis, the analysis changes what we anticipate the overall impact of the retirees on the liabilities, but it doesn't mean that we've changed our, it doesn't, it is keeping in, I guess, continuity, the fact that we continue to have a 7.75% investment return.
Correct.
Okay, thanks. Yep.
You're welcome. So Dan, if you don't mind, let's just go through, we're gonna focus on the executive summary. We're not gonna get into the detailed exhibits unless somebody wants to. But Dan, if you don't mind kind of going through the assumptions that we reviewed and the ones that we're proposing, that would be great.
First thing. So we're at the bottom of this page here where it says mortality basis. This was the first of several assumptions that we reviewed and have some proposed changes for. So the mortality table is used to approximate life expectancy. So this would have an impact on the cash flows that Rich had talked about. Folks are living longer than expected, then more benefits are being paid. and liabilities would be higher than expected. So what we're trying to do is keep an up-to-date table that most closely reflects expected life. So the current mortality table is an older mortality table. It's an RP-2014 table. That's a standard mortality table that the Society of Actuaries published, and it was using a MP-2018 mortality scale. These mortality scales are updated annually to try to approximate future changes and expected lifetime. It's fairly complicated. It's impossible to predict the future, but since we're making an expectation of the future, an assumption needs to be made regardless. A couple of years ago, the Society of Actuaries released a new mortality table tailored specifically to public sector plans. This is the PUB 2010 mortality tables, and this is what we ended up proposing, mostly because this is the newest table. It's tailored specifically for public sector employees, and when we went through the analysis, we found that the expected lifetimes versus what actually occurred, the number of passings over the last several years, closely aligned. So by updating from this older RP 2014 table to the newer PUB 2010 table, accrued liabilities increased by about 18 million, and the impact to the annual ADEC increased by 1.6 million. So this was a fairly substantial assumption. Were there any questions with the mortality table? So I guess we can just move on to the next page. There's three different assumptions on this page here. Termination rates are the probabilities that folks will stop working for the city before they are eligible for the regular retirement benefit. So those folks will either receive a vested benefit in the future, or depending on how many years of service they have, they'll just receive a refund of contributions. Our current assumption is an age and service-based table with different probabilities associated with whatever age and service that participant has. Once again, this has an impact on the future cash flows of the plan. When we examined this assumption, we found that the termination rates are closely aligned with the actual experience over the last several years. So we're not recommending any sort of change for the termination rates. And scroll down a little bit more, we have the next assumption here, age at retirement. So these are the retirement rates. Similar to the termination rates, these are age and service-based rates. These are probabilities that the employees will stop working for the city and retire and immediately begin their pension benefit. Similar to the termination rates, when we examine this assumption, the actual experience closely matched what our current assumption is. So just like with the termination rates, this assumption is still working appropriately. So we're not recommending any change for the retirement rates either. And the last one on this page is the salary scale. So this is an age and service-based table as well. These are the rates that pays are expected to increase over time. Folks with higher pays will end up receiving higher pension benefits. So this is another one of those assumptions that has an impact on the future cash flows for the active members. Examine this assumption, and just like with the other two assumptions I just went over, the expected pay increases are in line with what actually occurred over the last 5 years. So with the salary scale, this is a good assumption. We're not recommending any sort of change for this one. So now moving on, there's one more page of assumptions that we went through. So at the top here, it says overtime and longevity pay. This is an assumption that we examine, but is not currently being utilized. Overtime and longevity pay is something that is, it may be appropriate depending on the expected overtime that folks may utilize in their final years of working in order to enhance their benefit. What we found was for the SURF members, there wasn't substantial overtime worked for those folks in their last few years of working. So we don't think that it's appropriate to include an assumption to account for that. So similarly, we're not recommending any sort of assumption to account for any sort of spike in pay in the last few years. Payroll increase assumption. So this is an interesting assumption. So what's currently happening is for the calculation of the ADEC, there's an assumption that it will increase by 2% every single year. Typically, when there's an amortization, it's a level amortization. You can think of your typical house or car payment. It'll be $1,000 a month, every single month for the duration of the loan. But that's not the case for the payment of the ADEC. What's being done is it's built in to have an increase of 2% per year. So what's happening is payments are starting low and increasing over time by 2% in order to pay off the balance by the end of the duration. Now, Rich, I don't know if you have any comments about this, but this is a relatively uncommon assumption to use, and based on how it's currently set up, the amortization of unfunded liability doesn't currently cover the interest on the unfunded liability. Another way of saying that is all of the things being equal, the amount that the city's contributing isn't enough to increase the funded status of the plan. All of the things being equal, the funded status of the plan will continue to go down if all the other assumptions are met. What our recommendation is to lower that increase from 2% down to 1%. So instead of having payments increase by 2% per year, our recommendation is to have them increase by 1% per year. So this is going to increase the ABAC calculation by about 1.9 million. But by doing so, the amount that's being paid will cover the interest on the unfunded liability. Are there any questions with that?
I don't think, if I may, I'm sorry, I don't fully understand this, the payroll increase assumption. This is why is reducing the percentage increasing the liability?
Yeah, that's a good question. So you can think of it as your typical mortgage payment. It's a level dollar amount. So let's just say it's $1,000 each month. Now, if you have a mortgage or any sort of amortization that's being paid off that isn't level, you'll be making fewer payments in the beginning and then higher near the loan. So if you have loan that's 2% per year, you're starting with payments that are fairly low and ending that are fairly high. So you can think of it, it's like of an angle. It's going up over time. Now, by decreasing that 2% down to 1%, you're starting with a higher amount. So instead of having something that's increasing sharply over time, it's increasing less. So your starting payment ends up going up as a result, but your ending payment is not as bad. There's fewer dollars needed to pay off over time.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
Dan, is that the payroll inflator that you're speaking of, the inflator rate?
I'm having a little difficulty hearing you.
Is that the inflator rate on the payroll? Is that the inflator assumptions that you're speaking of, that 2%?
Derek, I think it's the same thing that you're referring to. Just to stick with Dan's example, if you have a mortgage of $1,000 a month for 30 years, that's more common. What an payroll increase assumption or inflator assumption does is it basically tilts the amortization payment. So rather than having $1,000 a month in your mortgage for 30 years, you start at 800. Then the next year you go to 810. And then the next year you go to 820. So you're starting lower, but what's going to happen at the end is you have to finish higher to get to the same place. So what we're suggesting you consider is trying to tilt it, and I'll say cut it in half. So rather than starting at 800, start at 900 and work your way towards a level dollar amortization. Does that help?
Yes, I get the analogy, but what I'm asking is what is this actual number? Does this number represent the inflation rate on expected payroll increases for employees? Is that what the actual number means?
You're talking about the 2%?
Yes.
What it's assuming is you are a level percentage of pay where the overall total payroll goes up 2% a year.
Rich, and correct me if I'm wrong, that would be the byproduct of collective bargaining, basically, where unions negotiate with the city, and if they can't come to a conclusion, then it goes to binding arbitration, and then another body external to the city makes a determination as to what that percentage is going to be. I'm saying, how realistic is it to say that you think that percent should be, instead of 2%, should be 1%. I mean, that's just like throwing darts in the dark, right?
Well, there are two assumptions related to salary. One is the salary increase assumption, which was the exhibit that Dan went over earlier. Mm-hmm. So those are individual increases in pay for each employee.
Caused by what?
Inflation and or merit increases, which typically is going to be the result of collective bargaining.
Right, okay.
Yep.
I'm with you. Good. So
this assumption is different. This assumption is specifically used for how much to tilt the amortization payment. So this tilts it on the presumption that your overall payroll is increasing 2% a year. If you want, let's think of it a different way. Let's go back to the mortgage example. We said $1,000 a month for 30 years. Another way to look at a mortgage payment is that payment as a percentage of somebody's income is going down. Presumably somebody's pay is going up, but there's still $1,000 a month for the mortgage. So the mortgage payment as a percentage of pay goes down. If you tilt your mortgage payment so it's a fixed percentage of your increases in pay, that's similar to what this is doing. It's trying to keep the amortization payment in line with the overall payroll growth. So as overall payroll goes up, the amortization goes up. So if you did that back to the mortgage example, you start with a mortgage payment that's 2% of your salary. If your salary goes up, your mortgage payment's still 2% of your salary, but your mortgage payment in terms of dollar amounts is going up.
What is the funded ratio of the plan as we speak?
I can pull up the last GASB report. Hold on a second. The last GASB sent over the plan is 37.5% funded.
Now, as trustees and fiduciaries, we should be doing everything within our power to try to improve that figure. Taking the assumption from 2% to 1%, is that going to be more injurious to the funded ratio? Is that going to make the funded ratio more perilous, the 35% or 32?
It will increase the funded percentage because the contribution is going up.
So if we said that the assumed increase on the payroll side will be 1% instead of 2%, that is going to be helpful to the funded ratio of the plan and therefore the health of the plan. Is that what you're saying?
Correct. The ADEC will go up $1.9 million. That's baked into the numbers that we had earlier in the report. But this is a decision point for you folks on if you're comfortable with this.
Rick, if it was, this is Susan Whetstone. If it was 2%, what would the number be? What would the ADAC contribution be?
It would decrease the 1.9 million.
Okay. So,
Leanna, if you can scroll back. Keep going. Oh, right. A little bit more. So that 26.08 million in the middle of the page.
Yeah.
That would go down 1.9 million. That would make it.
If we use the 2% figure.
Correct.
Okay.
So that'd be 24.18 million.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I had a couple of other questions, but I think that I, at least you're still trying to complete your presentation. Is that right?
We have just a few assumptions left to go over.
Okay.
The next one's actually the investment return assumption. So that might be a good time to just open the floor to the city's investment advisors as to what their thoughts are about the where that assumption should be. As Rich mentioned, we just provided two different expected returns just as a benchmark, just to provide a range of where the contributions will be, depending on where the investment return assumption falls.
Now, one thing I would note with the investment return assumption, in your GASB report, you have to provide an analysis that supports that assumption. So typically there's capital market assumptions, investment allocations, and a chart or exhibit that goes into your financials that is used to support this assumption.
We did send that over to you folks. You have it, correct? Hooker and Holcomb.
Yes, Derek, we have the analysis that you sent over. And this is what I was kind of referring to when I meant kind of in a collaborative way. We have to kind of look at this and with the board and with Derek, kind of look at, based on your investment allocation today, what's the investment return assumption? And if that works, that's great. If there is an appetite for seeing how do you get to a higher return, I think that's where Derek can help you and say, well, if you want to get to this investment return, here's how you have to invest the assets. Are you comfortable with that risk?
Derek, in the last 5 years, the actual investment performance of the fund, hasn't it surpassed the assumed rate of return in each one of those years?
Open variable. I think that's represented in the H&H report on one of the pages. I think you folks put it in there.
Yep, it's on the last page. Leanna, if you can scroll down to the very bottom. Yeah, so that's, yep, there you go.
There you go. If you could scroll up a little bit, Leanna, just to the top right there. So the most current. So you can see, Jerry, they've been variable. You know, it's been a variable rates of return. And correct me if I'm wrong, Rich and Dan, when you guys make these assumptions, they're typically 30-year assumptions, correct?
They're very long-term.
Right. So looking at 5-year returns is somewhat ambiguous. Even 10-year returns, I think you look out for 20 or 30 years, which is what we forecast out as well with our index returns. So you can see over the last 20 or 30 years, these returns are extremely variable, depending on, you know, obviously 10-year has a lot to do with it, market fluctuations, economics, expansions and contractions. So H&H uses smoothing methodology, I believe, correct?
You mean on the assets?
Yes.
Let me just take
So we use a 5-year smoothing calculate the actuarial value of assets. That's the asset value that we use for calculation of the ADAC.
So I guess getting back into long-term assumptions, you know, we presented it, we sent over to H&H and to Leanna our market assumptions for long-term 20, 30 years. We still contract with Mercer, so they're Mercer's assumptions actually. And they are less robust over the next 20 or 30 years for various reasons. One major reason is the 10-year, the risk-free rate of the 10-year. So when, you know, U.S. Treasury's at 5%, it's much easier to generate a 7.75% return when the 10-year is at 1% like it currently is. The spread between that 10-year and that 7.75% is rather large. So the only way to really generate those returns are in, you know, risk assets. So then it becomes, like Rich mentioned, the appetite for risk of the fund to generate an extra 675 basis points. You need to tilt the portfolio to more risk assets, i.e. equities, private investments, and things of the nature, less fixed income, less sleep well assets. So with the last 30 years, the 10-year treasury has been just going down. You know, that's a factor of various things that the Fed is doing. So, you know, that drives capital market assumptions down over the long term. Unless we think that the treasury yield is going to turn and move upward over the next 20 years, which is at this point very unlikely, we see the probabilities of getting that 7.75% as rather low. Now, that's not saying it can't be done. You know, we put in our report that we sent to H&H and to Leanna, you know, probabilities of outpacing our assumed rate, and there is a probability of that. However, it's like saying we're going to win every game in the next 20 seasons of, you know, baseball. It's fairly unlikely. You know, there's going to be some wins and some losses over time, which should bring the overall assumed rate down. I don't know, I'm speaking very generally. I don't know if Leanna has a report available to post. We can go over it, certainly.
What report, Derek, and when do you send it?
Sent it back when H&H asked for our capital market assumptions. I could try to find it, what the date was. I think it was January 6th. I can re-forward it if you'd like.
I'll have to look for it in my email.
I just resent it.
Okay.
Well, Rich, what am I, as our fund action is it your the trustees they should use a 7.75% assumed rate of return? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Well, the recommendation is to have support for the assumption. So using 7.75, if you have support for that assumption, then as the actuary, then I'm okay with it as long as there's support for it.
When you say support, you mean numbers that back it up?
Correct.
So do you, from what you're telling us, you do have those numbers in your report?
In this report?
The data that you're presenting to the trustees right now.
Yes.
What I'm saying is when you sift through it all, is it for being presented as somewhat of a justification that the funded ratio for the plan should remain at 7.75?
I think that's a decision point right now is...
Yeah, I know we make the decision ultimately. The trustees make that decision.
Can I ask a question about the page one recommendation? Because this is going to what Jerry's talking about, where you have the impact on 2020 actuarial valuation results. So I have two questions. One is on page one, your recommendation, the 7.75%, which is your recommendation. I'm trying to understand what's that based on, given what Raymond James is, what Derek is saying. But that is, I just want to be clear, that's your recommendation. And my second question is, at the 7% on that same page, the city normal cost goes to from 1.3 to 2.26. And my question is, what is that increase? Is that that 2% salary increase?
The change from the 1.3 to the 2.26 mm-hmm. is all related to decreasing investment return assumption from 7.75 to 7.
Oh, okay. That's all related to that. Okay.
Yeah, between
those. So it's still assuming the 1%.
Correct. If you want to change from the 1 to the 2, more or less, you take $1.9 million off of either one of those two numbers.
Okay.
And Derek, am I hearing the possibility that the continuation of a 7.75% assumed rate of return is potentially a little too aggressive going forward for the fund?
Yes, that's what's baked into the future long-term assumptions. That I think nationally, every pension across the country has reduced their assumptions at a graduated scale over time. And I think H&H has more information on that than we do, but the general trend of assumed rates of return for defined benefits in the public space has been a slide down. And I remember SERF was at 1.8 1/4, I mean, even 8.5 at one point in time. So I think every time we do these meetings, the trend is to cut that rate into something that's more in line nationally with defined benefit plans. Again, I think that's what Rich and Dan can speak to more so than me, but that is definitely the trend in your, with funds like yours.
Yeah, I would agree with Derek. If I remember the survey for the state of Connecticut, in the state of Connecticut municipalities, I think average is just under 7, if I remember correctly. Now, so that means there are some people above 7 and some people below 7, but that's one piece of information. It's just important to understand you have to have the support for the assumption. So if somebody's much more conservative than you, let's assume they're 70% in fixed income and 30% in equity, they're going to have a much lower assumption. If it's flipped and you're 70% equity and 30% fixed income, you're going to have a higher assumption.
Well, when you get into things like that, I think what everybody has to keep in mind is that some of those pension plans that are out there that are using a different assumption that maybe stays at 7.75 are cities, if it's a public plan, who allow their employees to pay into Social Security. So they don't need such a generous supplemental plan that the city provides. The city of New Haven doesn't have that luxury for their employees. Their employees were never allowed to pay in Social Security. Therefore, our plan is the police and fire and SURF is the only game in town. So we have to go for the biggest kill on return on investment. As I say, other cities and towns that employees are paying the Social Security, they say, well, fine, I know I'm gonna get a Social Security benefit, so I can have a city pension plan that is not as aggressive as New Haven. You gotta look at all these things.
Yep.
But I think as fiduciaries, the thing that I zone in on is that funded ratio. 37% is very anemic. And I think that as trustees, we should be looking at everything within our power to try to increase that funded ratio, because it's the only game in town that our employees have. And that's why I'm looking at the 7.75%, thinking that I think it's pretty much passe at this point, and that there should be an adjustment to that.
Could I ask a couple quick questions? 7%, I mean, from everything I'm hearing from other municipalities and states, is much more reasonable, obviously. You're, Rich, you're recommending, or maybe you wouldn't choose that word, that the reduction to 7% and the other changes to our assumptions, so that annually this would impact us by around $5 million additional payment, correct?
Correct.
You've done this analysis for PNF as well?
Yes.
Are you sharing that with PNF in the near future?
Yeah, I think we're scheduled to finish the report later today, right, Dan?
I presume that's happening. We'll
be finishing those results soon, and I think our meeting with the PNF board is later this week.
Okay. And the Thursday. This additional payment would impact our fiscal 22 year budget?
Let me pull up the
value. Fiscal year ending 2020.
Well, so we've already approved our budget for fiscal year 21, and we're in that budget now. So it sounds like Michael is going to chime in here.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, Mayor, correct. I think I'm not skipping ahead in the presentation, but PDF page 7 would basically show you the impact on the fiscal year's budget. We basically be going from, I believe, and I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me, but like 22.9 million to around 26 million at 7.5% and around 28 million. So that would have a significant impact on our budget when you throw in the PNF piece that they're finishing later today.
But just to be clear, Michael, it's not just the reduction of the 7.5 to 7%, but also their changes in the assumptions, which I imagine are similar with PNF, so that we're talking about probably an overall $15 to $20 million impact to the budget rather than a $10 million. Is that correct, Rich?
From our baseline to, I'm going to say, assume you do 7% investment return, you're right, it's about a $5 million increase.
For SURF.
I got to see if I can pull up the PNF.
And this is probably a question for Carolyn, and we're jumping ahead. I'm sorry, I've got another meeting, but Carolyn, your assessment is whatever the pension fund votes, the city's required to do?
That's correct.
And what if the pension fund voted for 5% investment rate of return?
That is what the plan says.
I didn't hear you.
That's what the plan is. The plan says that, sir. It's not the same for PNF. I'll have to look at that, but the plan says that this board sets the city's contribution.
I mean, there's got to be some limit to that, because why wouldn't the pension fund then set it to 1 so that we would increase the unfunded or decrease the unfunded liability significantly But because, that would be disastrous from the city's budget perspective.
Because I think, Mayor, it's incumbent upon the trustees to also have some realism in their the figure they're coming up with. They have to be able to.
I appreciate that, but from a legal perspective, realism or not, it doesn't impact anything.
Well, I mean, the board of aldermen could always bring the fund to court. That ultimately, that would probably be what decides it. But I still think, as trustees to the board, we can't come up with a figure that is like 1% when somebody would ask us the question, well, show us the justification for that. And the only answer to that is, well, we're greedy. So I think
but Carolyn, on the legal side, there's no limitation.
The way the plan reads, you are correct. Yes.
This is done every 5 years, Rich, this assessment?
No, it's done every 2 years. We set the ADAC.
Well, the experience study is done every 5 years. The ADACs, the valuations, are actually every other year.
Okay. And when was the last time that the recommendation was to reduce the rate of the return and the SURF board voted to reduce the rate of the return? You might not know that, but there's a lot of people that have been working on this for a long time. Has that ever happened before?
Yes. That happened before.
I mean, we've reduced the rate of return, but it was triggered, Michael, correct me if I'm wrong, by Mayor Harp and her team deciding to reduce it from 8 to 7.75, correct? So, Carolyn, in your recollection, this has never been done before, that the pension fund recommended and required the city to increase the ADEC because of the change in assumption of the investment return.
Oh, I'm sorry, Mayor. I'm just not sure about the history. I don't know the answer to that.
Eric, wasn't the rate, this is Kathy, Derek, wasn't the rate lowered several years ago?
I believe it was.
It was lowered from the 8.
Right, from 8, I think it went from 8 to 7.75. I don't know if it was 2 years ago, it might have been 4 years ago, but it was in fairly recent past, the rate was returned, was lowered from 8 to 7.75.
Well, about 3 or 4 years ago, so it could have been around the last study.
It was about two studies ago, right? So it was there every 2 years. So I think it was two studies ago.
Because I think I briefly remember looking at this rate and lowering it.
I can recall about 5 years ago, because historically what would happen is the actuary would usually meet with the city. And they would come up with a figure that they thought should be the rate of return. That became very contentious because the trustees said, listen, that's when we asked legal counsel to look into just what the trustees were involved in this process, to what extent, and determined the trustees intricately involved in it. And the trustees said, listen, from now on, the actuary will not speak with the city, it will come to the board. And it will discuss with the trustees what the assumed rate of return will be. Remember that, Carolyn?
Yeah. Well, I know it's in our code of conduct. It was very contentious. Okay,
that was an issue that brought it to a head. It was very contentious. I remember it, right? And at that point in time, the recommended assumed rate of return that the actuaries came to our board with was overturned by the trustees, and we forced it to be reduced. So I know it happened, and it happened on that particular occasion because it was a very contentious transaction that took place. And as a result of that, the figure that went over to the Board of Aldermen was reduced from what the actuary in the city had initially proposed to the trustees. And that's when the question came up, well, if this got into a pushing match with the Board of Aldermen, and our legal counsel opined at the time that once the trustees have determined what that is going to be and how it calculates out to the ADAC payment, That's what it is. End of story. Unless they want to make it a judicial issue. So I know on at least one occasion, we, the trustees, as a matter of fact, it was Trustee Zangari, I think, who raised the issue as to finding out exactly what the purviews were of the trustees and the whole process. And it was major with the trustees, how the trustees are involved in the determination of the assumed rate of return and ultimately how that calculates out to the ADAC annual payment.
Okay. Thanks, Jerry, for the history. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I just pulled up our July 1, 16 valuation report, and the investment return rate of assumption was reduced from 8 to 7.75.
That's right.
Yeah, I understand that. I guess my question is, it's, you know, just from, and I'm not saying moving it to 7 is a bad idea by any means, but the idea that the SERF pension fund could dictate to the city that we might have to pay $50 million additional in 1 year because they decide to reduce the rate to 5% or whatever it is problematic from a budgetary perspective from the city side. Not saying that anyone would do that because there's rational people on this board, but this is already going to potentially create a very, very difficult financial situation for us in an already very, very difficult budget year in fiscal 22. And if you add to that PNF, there's a major, major challenge that we're going to face that impacts existing employees dramatically. And so it's something that we all need to, I think about. And ideally, we do not make a decision in this meeting. Give us time to digest here.
This is Susan Whetstone again. Derek, you were going to go through some pages for us. I think we interrupted you, or I interrupted you. Do you want to go back to that?
I certainly can, if you'd like me to.
Yeah, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. So this was an asset allocation study. So let me just preface what goes into these studies. A lot of this is obviously, like we all spoke about, it's future forecast of some future result that may or may not occur. It's all done with passive indices. So, you know, we talk a lot on this board about active management versus passive indices, passive benchmarks. SERF has done a good job, I think, of combining both active and passive. So you could look at our most recent performance report, and we're vastly outperforming our passive benchmarks because of some of our good active managers. So these studies don't take those into account, the fact that there is potential for outperformance. All this is saying is, you know, again, Raymond James contracts with Mercer, and they just say, okay, Mercer puts up these future assumptions of passive equity and fixed income benchmarks and some alternative benchmarks, and says, okay, based on our calculations, we feel that, you know, the Russell 1000 index is going to generate X return over the next 20 years. And there have been obviously various inputs into that. So that's what this is. This is saying, okay, this is SERF's current allocation. This is SERF's investment policy statement allocation. Currently, this is not saying if we don't change it over time, which you all know, we make changes to the investment strategy, and we look at, you know, through advice and all of our interactions together, we make changes like we just did. We switched the fund from growth to value. We added small cap. So those are all active contributions to positive, in this case, positive performance. So again, this does not take that into consideration. So that said, it's a picture of a point in time and projecting that forward. So if, Nana, if you can scroll to, let's see. So this is just this just shows you what the expected returns are. I don't know if you can see it. It's very small on my screen. Page 3 would be good. I mean, I could talk about this page. This is just, So this shows various indices and the mean return, the geometric mean return. And you can see US all cap equities, 6.53. And again, these are 20-year expected returns. Non-developed US large caps, so this is international equity, 6.29. Bonds, 4%, cash, 2.7. International bonds, 3.55. What the overwhelming theme here is the only asset that is projected to outperform over that 7.75% is private equity. It says at 9.47. So obviously we can't put the fund at 100% private equity, but so the fund has done a nice job of adding those types of asset classes over the past handful of years. If you can scroll to the next page, please. So this just shows current allocation and expected rates of return from your IPS and your current 1130 performance report. You can see the mean is 6.56, your IPS is 6.16. And again, that's just a snapshot of the current allocation and their expected future returns. That's not at all what we're saying we think we can generate. Just next page, please. Okay, so now this just shows, what I said to you earlier is, this is where you fall. So if you say, okay, well, 50th percentile, within statistical evaluations, 50th percentile is a high level of probability. And you can see the various 1 year, 5 year, 10 year, and 20 year expectations. But what I want to point out is, you see the 6.62 is within 50th percentile, if you look over 20 years, it goes all the way up to 11.52 if you're in the 95th percentile of, if you generate within the 95th percentile of returns. So there is variability there. And we feel that with good level of confidence, you're going to be north of 662, but certainly less than 11.52. So 7.75 is robust. Certainly we would back to 7 and anywhere in between. Obviously, we don't set the rate of return. You do. We just show you what we think the markets can generate over time. And this does not take into account, again, any active management of the fund, any active changes to the allocation. This is just a static group of allocations into the future. If you could go to the next page, Leanna. So this just goes to show you, so this puts some probability of returns. And you can see up on top the 5, 6, 7, 8% rate of return, and then over the 20-year period, because obviously that's what we're talking about here. So, with 58.94% probability, you get a 6% return. 7% return is 44.25% probability. That's fair. That's a fair level of probability. And again, it's not overly robust because a lot of this is taking into consideration where the markets are and where we think they're going to go over the next 20 years. So I think the assumptions that Rich and his group at Hooker and Holcomb have presented have merit. I think it makes sense certainly to consider reducing it. That's up to you. That's not anything we can opine on. All we can show is these are statistical, future forecasts of the various markets and the current allocation of the fund. But what we would note is that the fund can change its allocation to either increase or decrease these returns. So we feel comfortable with taking on more risk over time if that's something that makes sense to you as a board. But again, it's something that the board has to be comfortable with. It would create more volatility in the fund, but with the need to generate higher rates of return, that would be the only real way to generate those returns, is to increase risk.
I honestly don't see how a fund ratio of 37% can afford to get risky. That's my own opinion. I don't think we have that luxury.
Well, with that said, I mean, I think that these just back up the numbers and of what our expectations are. Mm-hmm. And again, I think this board has done a very good job of generating higher than expected rates of return because it's done a lot of active things, i.e. changing the allocations, picking superlative managers, its flexibility on changing methodologies of investing. So this board has done a lot over the last several years. I think it's really being witnessed in the results of the fund. So this fund is outperforming quite a bit. I think we're in the top 5 percentile of public funds your size over the last fiscal year and the last 3 years. So I don't know if that's, I have that chart up. It's not in this report, but I have another report I can send you that shows that this fund has done a very good job. It's in the top 5% of other public funds, and it's within its class. But it's made good decisions. It's good. It's made some good policy changes. It's picked active managers that have done well. So all of these things help the case to get a more robust rate of return.
Well, I think the fund performed well because we had some very sound advice from our financial consultants.
Thank you. I don't have anything further to say within this presentation. I mean, you guys could all look at it. If there are any questions, I can try to answer them.
Dan, when are you meeting with police and fire?
On Thursday.
It's Thursday morning that we're meeting.
So being new to this is Susan again. If we were to stay at the 7.5%, but not able to make that rate, that the consequence would be increasing the unfunded liability?
Yeah, effectively. What will happen is you'll generate asset losses in the future, which would then increase future years' 8X.
Thank you.
Hey, Rich, can I ask a question?
Sure.
When did the fund, I remember a meeting where the fund was talking about opening amortization versus closing the amortization. It was just recently that this board closed their amortization, was it not?
It was a couple of years ago. I think, Dan, what's our amortization period now?
So for the 2020 valuation, it's down to a 22-year.
Right. So what impact did the opening amortization have on the funded ratio of this plan?
The closed amortization period would...
Well, no, I asked when the fund was open amortization for many years, what impact did that have on the funded ratio of the plan?
It would tend to suppress the funded ratio. Think of it as having a 30-year mortgage, and every year you refinance over 30 years. So if you keep doing that forever, you never pay off your mortgage. You keep getting closer. And the board decided to close that period and basically say, here's our mortgage. We're gonna pay it off.
Right. And that just happened a handful of years ago, correct?
Yeah, it happened a few valuations ago. We're 22 now, so in 18 we would have been at 24. In 16 it would have been 26. So it was a few valuations ago.
And what is the current funded ratio?
37%, if I remember correctly.
37.5, wasn't it?
Yes.
Does the board have a goal for a funded ratio?
Wasn't that amortization to an 80% fund ratio, Rich? Wasn't that the goal? The amortization, wasn't it to over 28 years to bring it to an 80% funded ratio?
I believe it was 80, Derek.
Yeah, 80 is a pretty common benchmark.
And against that standard, because I assume you would have had an over the 20 years, it would go from, let's say, 37 to 40 to 45. Where are we against that schedule towards reaching the 80%?
Well, if you go back to June 30th, 16, you were at 33%. 33.4. So you've increased it from 33.4 to 37.5.
And Susan, part of our problem is that it was underfunded for a long time. And this is the impact of that. And we were trying to play catch up by being a bit more aggressive.
Could I ask a question on timeline here? And this is maybe a question for, I don't know if it's Michael or Cormany. How urgent is it that we make this decision quickly?
I think we have a few weeks or a week or so to do it, Mayor. As you know, the budget has to be submitted to the office March 1st, which generally means the second week of February. I need to have everything finalized, start putting together the large book and everything. What I will say is, I would suggest that we wait a week or so to make this decision, because to be very honest, as the mayor mentioned earlier, this is going to have a budgetary impact in a tight year that we're already in. And then we're also looking at the PNF increase as well. So, it takes me months to put together a budget. So if you're talking about increasing a number by $20 million, so $15 or $20 million, that's going to have a significant impact on the numbers that we're looking at already for fiscal year 22. So that's basically my timeline there, is that, by the second week of February, I need to basically have numbers solidified and everything to start putting everything together for your submission to the Board of Alders.
Thanks. Rich, you presented figures today that show what the cost will be for the ADAC if the funded ratio stays constant at 7.75%. And you've also done a comparison as to what it would be at 7%. Have you done any figures on 7.5%, 7.25%?
Thank you, Jerry. Sorry, Rich. Jerry, thanks. That was my next question, Rich, is did you do increments of like a quarter of a percent,
right,
going down?
We have not. We've done the range. If you're interested in something like 7.5, you can actually just interpolate and I'll get you pretty close.
I think we'd like to see those figures.
But Rich, that doesn't impact the first number, correct? The 2.78 annual change.
Correct.
I don't have a well-formed question here, but should we be thinking about these two things differently as far as how the pension fund might determine? It seems to me that it's potentially unfair to expect the city to adjust to such an abrupt financial change, but we might step down and have an agreement that each year we go down by 2.5% or 0.25% or something along those lines. But with the 2.78 million number, that's something that you're just saying we have a bad assumption based on the time people retire and die and such, that we should just adjust that immediately, correct?
Correct, with one exception, the decision point on the increasing amortization. You're currently using 2%.
2% to 1%.
Correct. That was 1.9.
But that's more than half of that number.
Correct.
Okay. And spoiler alert, are we likely to see the PNF numbers being similar to this as far as what our estimates are and problems are?
Yeah, I mean, the PNF numbers will be bigger.
I know.
But order, well, relatively speaking, yes.
Okay. Yeah, my strong preference is that we punt this decision for is to give the city some time to digest the impact here. And you know, ideally we reconsider this. I'm not sure if a week gives us enough time, but we want to make sure that we're able to understand the impact of this, frankly, on the main thing, on existing employees.
Mike, this is Leanna. If we put it off to the February SURF meeting, would that be too late? I think that's the 17th, I want to say.
Yeah, most likely that would be too late. Unless okay. Unless we can have the meeting like a week earlier, you know, that may work. As opposed to the 17th, because we're just cutting it very, very close.
Could we do a special meeting like this one next Tuesday? Would that work?
I don't know. I would prefer, you know, maybe after next week if that's a better timeline for everyone.
How about like the 9th, which would be 2 weeks?
Yeah. Again, I think with the impact, and Rick can correct me if I'm wrong, but usually even at the 7.75%, we're looking at 2.78 million. PNF has usually been almost double that figure. It's just because of the way that their pension works and the assumptions that are made. So, I mean, you know, without seeing the figure, you can almost say $10 or $11 million just at the 7.75%, which is a very big adjustment that I have to make going into fiscal year 22.
I mean, maybe if I make a suggestion that we could kind of look at the timeline with Leanna offline and not to figure that out in this meeting, but make a commitment to have this in a timely manner, this decision made in a timely manner. Would that be all right with folks? Carolyn's anxious to chime in here. Anything you want to add, Carolyn?
No, not at all.
No. Did the trustees want to take a vote on this officially to defer this?
Yeah, I'd move to continue the item.
Motion's made and continues is seconded.
This is Mark Petrosimone, I'll second it.
Is there a discussion on this motion? In the absence of a motion properly made and second, all in favor indicate by saying aye by identification.
This is Kathy Graves, aye.
Mark Petrosimone, aye.
Michael Gormley, aye.
Susan Whetstone, aye.
Justin Ellicker, aye.
No opposition, no abstentions. The motion is passed. Thank you.
Could I ask if it be possible at our next meeting to have an additional piece of information from Derek? What would our risk need to look like if we wanted to achieve 7.5? How much risk would we have to add to the current portfolio?
I'll try to get something for you that would answer that question, Susan.
Okay.
Rich, you will be presenting the figures for the 7.5 and 7.25 also, right? The calculation for the ADAC based on that?
For PNF?
For SURF. Well, both. I assume PNF is going to want that also for their fund.
Well, you have 7.75. I actually just did a quick interpolation. 7.5 is going to put you around 26.9 million.
What's 7.25 approximately?
Let 27.7.
Pat, I assume you're going to want those figures for your meeting on Thursday also, right? For your fund?
That is correct.
Okay. And Rich, you can provide those to that meeting on Thursday for PNF?
Yeah, we can do the interpolation quick and provide that.
Okay, thank you. Can we go on to the next item, which is getting approval for our legal counsel to review the contract with Markham. Am I correct, Carolyn?
That's correct. And to add to that, this is a waiver of a conflict of interest. And
Karen, before you get into that, if I could just explain to the trustees again what the issue is or what, sure. what the item is. There is an election coming up for the two labor union representatives on the SURF board. This is done by election of the membership and the retirees. People actually retired. And there's a nomination process. It's a pretty intricate thing. And the trustees have always, in order to make sure that there was transparency, that everything was done in an equitable manner, have gone to independent auditors to conduct this election. That being the case, we've had Liana reach out to try to get to solicit cost factors from three or four area independent auditors. And correct me if I'm wrong, Liana, but it appears that Markham is the most competitive bidder right now. Am I correct?
Yeah, the trustees voted to go with Markham at last week's meeting.
That's right. Okay. That being the case, Markham has been selected by the trustees based on a competitive process. And now there has to be a contract that is used to enter into with Markham. And we're asking legal counsel for our fund, Brenner and Saltzman, to conduct the legalities involved to review that process. And Carolyn is saying that it would require the trustees to provide a formal waiver, which allows the papal dispensation to Brenner and Saltzman to conduct those legalities.
Right. And very quickly, our firm has, although I personally have not represented Markham in employment matters, so that under our rules of professional conduct, for us to look at this retainer or this engagement letter, which I've quickly looked at, and there are some issues, we need you to waive the conflict so our firm can negotiate, or I can negotiate this with Markham. Markham has waived the conflict, and the waiver just basically says whatever attorney-client privilege in terms of communications with the board will remain. If it ever comes to a lawsuit between Markham and the board, I would not represent either party, or the firm wouldn't represent either party if we came to loggerheads on that. And basically, there's a waiver letter that would need to be signed as well as the retainer letter. So I'm asking that you waive the conflict so that I can review this retainer letter.
Is there a motion by a trustee for that waiver?
Mr. Chair, this is Mark Petrosimone, and I'll make that motion.
This is Kathy. I'll second it.
Motion made and second. Is there discussion on that, on the waiver, on the motion? Yes, the motion is properly made and second. All in favor indicate aye by voice identification.
This is Kathy. Aye.
Mark Petrosimone. Aye.
Michael Gormany. Aye.
Susan Whetstone. Aye.
Justin Ellicott. Aye.
Thank you. I have an additional question. In terms of signing the waiver letter, signing the retainer, under the bylaws, only the chairperson can sign. Do you want to retain that, or do you want to delegate that to Leanna? Because that would also require a vote. Jerry, would you be available to sign those documents?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Can I also ask, after this meeting's over, if Leanna and Jerry And Dave and Derek could quickly just stay on for some quick questions.
Yep. I think all the business has been conducted. If that's the case, can I entertain a motion to adjourn?
So moved, Kathy.
Is there a second?
Mark Petrosimone, second.
Is there a discussion on this motion? In the absence of a motion properly made and second, all in favor indicate aye by voice identification.
This is Kathy, aye.
Mark Petrosimone, aye.
Michael Gormley, aye.
Susan Whetstone, aye.
Justin Ellicker, aye.
No opposition, no abstentions, the motion carries. Thank you very much.
Have a good day.
Have a good one.
Thank you.